This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Debt buyers purchase outstanding debts from banks for pennies on the dollar, but have not been required to validate debts before pursuing lawsuits against consumers. Multnomah County records indicate debt buyer company lawsuits against consumers have increased 5,400% between 1999 and 2012. The industry is rife with abuse, collecting debts that have already been paid and creating exhausting legal headaches for citizens. On Tuesday, April 16th, the Oregon House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency will have a work session on House Bill 2826, which will increase legal consumer protection from debt buyers if passed. For more on the bill's potential positive impact on consumers, Ren Green spoke to Angela Martin, Executive Director of Economic Fairness Oregon, which helped develop HB 2826. Angela, can you give us some background on the bill and what it's for?
Right. House Bill 2826 is dealing with a fairly new industry, debt buyers. The goal of the bill is to crack down on what are essentially junk lawsuits, lawsuits filed by debt buyers who purchase large portfolios of stale debt from the original creditor, mostly big banks. They purchase this for pennies on the dollar, receive very little underlying information or documentation about who owes, how much is owed, or whether the debt is even still valid. But yet they file these lawsuits in our state court and demand full payment on these delinquent accounts. Last year in Oregon, 32,000 lawsuits were filed by debt buyers against Oregonians.
And what is the impact of these, the debt buyers, on consumers?
The impact is everything from time spent trying to unwind a wrongful judgment, obviously the money that goes along with that, and great emotional stress. Let me tell you a quick story. Talking with a gentleman whose name is Ravine, he didn't even know he was being sued by a debt buyer until his employer came to him to let him know that his wages were being garnished. Ravine contacted an attorney, found out that he had been sued, a judgment had been entered against him, and now his wages were subject to garnishment. When they pulled the affidavit of service to see who was served with the original lawsuit, you could see the errors in it. It was filed against a female. Ravine is a male. He was able to unwind the judgment and unwind the garnishment, but again, this took hiring an attorney, putting in a lot of time, effort, and energy, all for something that should not have taken place in the, to begin with.
What are the mechanisms by which House Bill 2826 will rein in debt buyer abuse?
What we're asking for is actual proof before you file a lawsuit. And this proof should be established at three points. Number one, 30 days before filing a lawsuit against a consumer, the debt buyer would send a notice to the consumer saying who's suing them, who the original creditor was, and how much they owe. Not just some ballpark amount, but breaking it down. Principal, interest, and any fees that's been added on. This is key because then the consumer knows whether or not this is a valid debt and can dispute it if their records show something different. Number two, we need to provide proof to the courts. We know that, again, 32,000 lawsuits filed in Oregon courts, most of the time the consumer isn't showing up. The courts need to have accurate information proving who owes the debt, who, how much is owed, and what the statute of limitations are. So debt buyers would be required to provide this information to the court at the beginning of the lawsuit and at the end before a judgment is entered.
What is Economic Fairness Oregon's role in the development of HB 2826?
You know, the basis of House Bill 2826 really comes from recommendations put out by the Federal Trade Commission. The FTC has done an extensive study of the abuses in debt collection, debt buyer industry. And they made some really clear recommendations to states on how the process for filing lawsuits should be changed to end these abuses. So Economic Fairness Oregon literally read through the list of recommendations and put those into a bill, House Bill 2826.
Do you think House Bill 2826 is going to adequately protect consumers from debt buyers?
I do believe so. We know that if consumers have the information about who is suing them, how much they allegedly owe on the debt, they will have a fighting chance to either pay what they lawfully owe or defend themselves in court. And that's what's not happening right now. Consumers don't have the information they need to adequately defend themselves in court.
So it's basically about making sure debt buyers put all their cards on the table up front.
That's a perfect way to say it. House Bill 2826 is up for a vote in the House Consumer Protection Committee next week. Anyone who's interested in learning more can certainly go to our website, economicfairnessoregon.org. Anyone interested in weighing in on this should call their lawmaker and urge them to vote yes on 2826.
I've been talking with Angela Martin, the Executive Director of Economic Fairness Oregon. This is Ren Green for KBOO News.
Two major Oregon transportation projects received support in the budget released by President Obama last week. For the second year, the White House has set aside funds for the 7-mile-long Portland-Milwaukee light rail. Over $100 million will go to constructing the light rail through grant agreements with the Federal Transit Administration. The president's budget also sends $65 million to the controversial Columbia River Crossing, an expansion of I-5 between Portland and Vancouver. The Columbia River Crossing will cost an estimated $3.5 billion. Oregon lawmakers have so far only approved $500 million. Even with proposed funding from the state of Washington, a $2.5 billion gap for the program still exists.
The Oregon House Education Committee approved House Bill 3014, which would require all public and charter school classrooms to display the American flag and give students a daily opportunity to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. Under current law, public schools must provide students with the chance to say the pledge once a week, though kids are not required to actually say it, and there are no comparable laws governing charter schools. The bill was introduced by Representative Sal Esquivel, a Republican from Medford, who feels schools are not adequately honoring America's flag, and cited a Waldorf-based charter school in his district that does not display the stars and stripes in classrooms or require students to recite the pledge. According to the Oregonian, the Madrone Trail Public Charter Schools director, Joseph Frodsham, says the school is not teaching children to be anti-patriotism. Students are simply not asked to repeat pledges they don't understand. Frodsham, who served in the military for 5 years and keeps a flag in his office, said the school's first class of eighth graders will be required to study the Pledge of Allegiance in American history class next year. House Bill 3014 was unanimously supported by the House Education Committee, including Jeff Reardon, a Democrat from Portland, who thinks schools should make time for the pledge every day. The bill will go to the Oregon House and Senate for a full vote.
Oregon Secretary of State Kate Brown released an audit stating the Oregon university system should improve student debt tracking and control rising education costs. The audit demonstrates that tuition has hiked beyond the Oregon legislature's higher education cuts over the last 2 years. In 2001, the state contributed $941 million to the university system, but that amount has been reduced to $678 million. According to Audits Division Director Gary Blackmer, higher tuition may be partially related to increased expenses of the public employees' retirement system and health benefits. Blackmer recognizes Oregon universities are under financial pressure, but noted the numbers don't easily show whether institutions are systematically improving the system and protecting education quality. Oregon university system officials balked at the audit's recommendations. They claim Oregon already offers some of the nation's most efficient and inexpensive college education. Interim Chancellor Melody Rose penned the official university response, stating the system does not need new cost tracking, reporting, or evaluation methods. Rose wrote that the audit's recommendations will add expenses while not necessarily solving budget problems.
After more than 8 years, the city of Portland and Multnomah County hit the reset button on their 10-year plan to hit homelessness. The new plan seems to rely on private funding, and details are still being worked out. For more, KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with Multnomah County Commissioner Deborah Kafori.
The 10-year plan to end homelessness is dead. Long live the new plan to alleviate homelessness with an open time frame. This plan is an update to account for the simple reality of ongoing homelessness and the less simple reality of austerity. For details, I spoke with Multnomah County Commissioner Deborah Crafori.
Multnomah County and the City of Portland and Home Forward, which is the housing authority, decided that we needed to take a look at the 10-year plan to end homelessness and do some readjustments.
Would you say you heard well from the man on the street in revising the plan?
We have tried to include many different voices in the reset. We have a large group. I don't know how many people are on it, but we have providers. We have law enforcement. We have the business community. We have consumers. So we're really trying to, and then, of course, the government. We're really trying to get a broad look from everyone whose lives are touched by homelessness in our community.
A notable part about the old plan was in the title, it said 10-year.
It's unfortunate that they chose the 10-year to be in the title, but that was a mandate from the federal government. So every community that receives federal dollars at the time was supposed to put together a 10-year plan to end homelessness. We know that homelessness has been around for a lot longer than 10 years and will probably exist in another 10 years. So we're trying not to refer to a specific time frame. With the new plan, which, let me be clear, we've just adopted kind of a framework. The next few months are going to be spent really putting the meat on the bones of this plan. And we will have goals with timelines attached and dollar amounts attached so that people understand, the community understands, that if we want to reduce homelessness by X percentage, it's going to cost X number of dollars, which is something that we don't have now.
What do you hope this achieves?
I think the 10-year plan was great. I mean, I think at the time it was innovative and creative, and they had a lot of input. But as I said, with any strategic plan, you need to take periodic adjustments and look at what's worked and what could be done differently.
If you had to point to one thing that's going to be different, that's going to change life for the guy in the street, what would that be?
Well, I'm hoping that with a new look, we will get new investments. I really, that's my goal, is that we have specific strategies to address different things, you know, homelessness for veterans, homelessness for families, homelessness for youth, and that we can take those strategies and go out into the community to funders, philanthropy, the business community, and say, here's the way that we can address these issues, but we need your help, and that they will help fund those strategies. I think that people are in the community, both taxpayers and, you know, just kind of the general man on the street, goes downtown and sees there's a lot of homeless folks. And they say, wow, what's our government doing? So when we have specific strategies set out that with X number of dollars we can reduce homelessness in this area, that people think, what gives people the opportunity to say, that's where I want to get involved. I really care about homeless families, so that's the area that I'm going to make the investment in.
I think I see what you're saying. So the taxpayer dollars are amplified if our government incentivizes properly private industry, basically, to
help solve the problem.
To help solve the problem.
Yep.
That's working good.
I think there are still a lot of folks in our community who are suffering. As we all know, we see it every day. But there's also a lot that we don't see. Most of the homeless families we don't see on the streets. There are a lot of people who are suffering, and it's incumbent upon us to try to change that.
Right on. So what's a good takeaway message for our listeners then about the new plan?
I think that we have a good start, and in the next few months we'll come out with some more specifics, and I would say I'd love to have people be involved. They can call my office, 503-988-5220, or send me an email at deborah.cafori@moltco.us, and let me know their thoughts, concerns, questions.
That was Multnomah County Commissioner Deborah Cafori. The new plan to alleviate homelessness depends heavily on private funding. Details of the plan are still being worked out. Stay tuned to KABU for continuing coverage. And this is Joe Meyer with KABU News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, a discussion of filmmaker Pamela Yates' new documentary, Granito, about the genocide of indigenous people in Guatemala. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, scattered showers, temperatures in the mid-50s throughout the weekend.
It's 5:19, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Here's a scientific conclusion that even a professional science denier would accept. Being stuck in line, on an airplane, in a waiting room, or anywhere else with someone loudly nattering inanities into their cell phone is somewhere between irritating and infuriating. You don't really need a PhD in human psychology to come to this conclusion, but it turns out that quite a few scientists have been conducting research on the obvious, probing the whys behind the annoyance of cell phone chattering. A new study out of San Diego University concludes that two factors are at play here. One is simply the trapped response. You're stuck in a place with this cackling conversation assaulting you, so your stress level quickly builds to a boil. The other is what scientists are calling the half-a-log factor. Unlike hearing two people carry on a conversation, we hear cell phoners yakking with someone who's not there, so we're getting only half of what's being said. Psychologists say that this hijacks an innocent bystander's brain, which can't help but search for some logic in what it's receiving. Thus, our gray cells involuntarily struggle to put the half-a-log into a dialogue, distracting us from our own thoughts or disrupting a simple moment of solitude. Another study found that the brain perceives the one-sided conversation to be abnormally loud, even when it's not. This not only drives us to distraction, but also to a simmering fury, ultimately chauffeuring us right up to the dark precipice of antisocial behavior. This is Jim Hightower saying, as one who's been brought to that edge several times, it seems to me that the people prattling on so rudely are the antisocial ones. I appreciate the recent scientific attention to this uncouth narcissism, but wouldn't it be better to address it at the kindergarten level?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
After being closed for more than a year, Southern California's San Onofre nuclear power plant is being fast-tracked for a restart. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission determined one idled reactor is safe to run at lower power. The preliminary ruling is a victory for Southern California Edison, which seeks to restart the Unit 2 reactor by June. FSRN's Larry Buell has more.
San Onofre, located between Los Angeles and San Diego, has not produced electricity since January of 2012, when a small radiation leak led to the discovery of much broader damage. This week, NRC staff said restarting Unit 2 at 70% power would not pose a significant safety risk. The final decision rests with the commission's board. Critics like Kendra Ulrich with Friends of the Earth say NRC staff is moving towards using an obscure public hearing technicality to restart the nuclear reactor without proper public input.
What Edison has done is literally take safety and make it a footnote at the bottom of the page.
Earlier this week, California Senator Barbara Boxer sent a letter to the NRC urging it not to act without completing a comprehensive investigation and providing a full opportunity for public participation. The NRC did not respond to that letter. Larry Buell, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Newly released documents reveal that the Internal Revenue Service may be reading private taxpayer emails without a warrant. The American Civil Liberties Union obtained legal memos from the Tax Collections Agency's Criminal Investigation Division this week through a Freedom of Information Act request. Among the hundreds of pages handed over to the ACLU was a 2010 document from the IRS Office of Chief Counsel that reads, quote, "The Fourth Amendment does not protect emails stored on a server." The memo then tells agents that there is no privacy expectation for those emails. Attorney Nathan Wessler with the American Civil Liberties Union disagrees.
even in the earliest days of email, people were using email as a form of communication where they might be sharing very sensitive and private details about their lives, things about their relationships, their religious affiliation or political views, maybe medical information. So we think, and courts agree, that emails, just like letters or just like the contents of our phone calls, needs to be protected by the Fourth Amendment.
Under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, written in the mid-1980s, any email that's older than 180 days can be read by the government without a warrant. But in 2010, a circuit court ruled that the Fourth Amendment does apply to email and said government agents must have probable cause and a warrant to read them. The ACLU is demanding further information from the IRS, the FBI, and the Justice Department on whether they're following that court ruling in their email surveillance practices. Wessler said if the government violates the Fourth Amendment for people suspected of tax fraud, it's likely to do so while investigating other crimes.
It's really incredible to us that in 2013, when virtually every American uses email and text messages and other similar services to communicate, we don't know what the standards are that federal law enforcement is applying when it seeks to read those communications.
This week, the House of Representatives Intelligence Committee approved a cybersecurity bill called CISPA that would facilitate even more sharing of private online information with the government. The ACLU and other privacy advocates are opposing the legislation, which is expected to come to the floor for a vote in the next few weeks.
The Republican National Committee today passed two resolutions cementing the party's stance as strongly against gay marriage. The resolutions define marriage as between one man and one woman and reaffirm it as a core value of the GOP. One calls on the Supreme Court to rule against same-sex marriage in pending cases addressing that issue. Although some members of the committee reportedly disagreed with the resolutions in private, both issues passed unanimously by a voice vote without debate. The votes come as part of the organization's spring meeting in Hollywood, where Republican officials gathered to discuss new ways to rebrand the party.
France's Senate voted today to legalize same-sex marriage. The vote comes on the tail of a violent attack on a gay man in Paris and overall rise of anti-gay violence in the country. The latest attack has become a rallying point for LGBT activists in France. The bill also includes provisions to allow same-sex couples to adopt. The National Assembly, or lower house, passed the measure in February, but additional votes are required in both legislative bodies before the law can be finalized. In other LGBT rights news, yesterday lawmakers in Delaware introduced a bill to legalize same-sex marriage. Delaware Governor Jack Markell has already pledged his support for the legislation.
For the first time in Chile's 2013 school year, hundreds of thousands of students marched to protest inequality in the country's educational system. In Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garitón has more.
Student leaders say more than 200,000 students marched in cities across Chile Thursday, demanding quality, free public education and an end to profiteering in voucher schools and private universities. The largest march took place in Santiago, where nearly 150,000 university and high school students marched with supporters from the teachers' union and other social organizations. 2013 is an election year in Chile, and the large march was intended to show strength and send a powerful message to all presidential candidates. The ruling conservative parties supported the current educational model based on private enterprise and parental choice. Students have earned broad support from the population and have had some recent successes in influencing proposals put forward by center-left parties. Students have been marching against market-driven education since 2006 and now appear close to forcing major changes to the system. Jorge Garretón, FSRN, Santiago.
A collection of ancient Hopi objects were sold at an auction in Paris today for more than $1.2 million. The artifacts, described by the auction house as masks, have been identified as living beings by members of the Hopi community. Members of the Hopi tribe in northeastern Arizona called the sale a desecration of an object they deem sacred. Despite diplomatic pressure from the United States, a legal suit brought by the Hopi, and protests from figures like Robert Redford, a French court refused to prevent the commercial sale of the artifacts. The auctioneer told a packed crowd of bidders and protesters that the objects were, quote, no longer sacred, but instead had become important works of art. One of the artifact buyers told Reuters that without 19th century collectors, there would be, quote, little knowledge of the Hopi. According to the 2010 census, more than 18,000 Hopi live in the United States. According to multiple reports, a number of protesters were physically removed from the auction house, including one woman who was thrown out in tears while shouting, quote, this is not merchandise, these are sacred beings. The auctioneer went on to describe the sale as a, quote, homage to the Hopi, who, quote, should be happy that so many people want to understand and analyze their civilization.
Lakota grandmothers were denied access to the United Nations today while trying to deliver a complaint accusing the United States of ongoing genocide. The grandmothers and their 100 supporters sought an audience with high-ranking UN officials following their march through New York City. Instead, their delegation was herded into a park outside UN headquarters and met by security personnel. This according to a press release at lakotagrandmothers.org. One grandmother accused the UN of failing to live up to their 1948 convention charter, which calls for the respect of treaty obligations. The delegation is part of the Lakota Truth Tour. It's traveling across North America to tell their story of genocide. The tour, now in its 11th day, stops next in Washington, D.C. to meet with U.S. officials.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Meyer, Robin Ryan, Ren Green, Rachel Bennett, and Evan Owen Stively. The producer is Zeke Harrington. Special thanks to the reporters at Free Speech Radio News. You can hear more of their stories at fsrn.org. Our engineer is Ian Gadbury. The KBOO Interim Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Rebecca Ney. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Ren Green.
I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey speak with Stephen John Hartnett about his book, Executing Democracy, Capital Punishment and the Making of America. At 9 on the Old Mole Variety Hour, the Movie Moles review the new Jackie Robinson biopic. The well-read Red, Alan Weider, commemorates the 20th anniversary of the assassination of South African freedom fighter and communist Chris Hani. And Bill Resnick talks about attacks on Social Security. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein hosts a radical analysis of our master-slave relationship to the energy with Andrew Nikiforuk. And at 11 on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman speaks with Michael Moss about the rise of the processed food industry, its link to the emerging obesity epidemic, and how we can fight back. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. If you missed it, you can still contribute. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. Now stay tuned for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, a discussion of filmmaker Pamela Yates' new documentary, Granito, about the genocide of indigenous people in Guatemala. Have a great weekend. Good night, Ren.
Good night, Liam.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, Margaret Thatcher's death brought a wave of gushing coverage of the former prime minister, who was credited for bringing her country into the modern world by vanquishing powerful unions and privatizing inefficient public services. Journalist Laura Flanders remembers a different Thatcher legacy. She'll join us to talk about it. Also on the show, detainees at Guantanamo have engaged in a life-threatening hunger strike for months, a stark representation of the desperation of men, a majority of whom have been cleared to leave the prison yet are still held there, with no end to their detention in sight. Guantanamo is something of a journalistic black hole as well. We'll talk about the effort to shed light on it with Pardis Kebriay, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
U.S. media had plenty to say about former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, much of it glowing. Fox's Bill O'Reilly, along with his conservative guests Britt Hume and Bernard Goldberg, lavished praise on the conservative icon. Among her accomplishments, according to the host, was bringing unemployment down from 13% in 1982 to 5.8% when she left office in 1990. Nice trick on O'Reilly's part, but counting Thatcher's entire tenure from 1979 to 1990, unemployment actually rose from 5.6% to 7.9%. It's natural that Fox should remember Thatcher fondly and that Bill O'Reilly is caught torturing statistics, but the spectrum of opinion on PBS's NewsHour was hardly better. PBS featured Republican Secretaries of State George Shultz and James Baker, both big fans of Thatcher's foreign policy. More than that, as Baker proclaimed, she, quote, emphasized the private sector and got rid of the oppressive influence of the trade unions, close quote. Shultz added, thoughtfully, that Thatcher was, quote, a very attractive woman, so you were certainly aware of that, close quote. Another conservative NewsHour guest, former Canadian Prime Minister Kim Campbell, also cheered Thatcher's defeat of unions and praised her humanity. It's kind of touching to be reminded of what a lovely woman she was. Thatcher